Welcome to Newsworthy with Norisworthy. Get ready for some awesome.
Welcome back to the show. Today we have with us from Tallahassee, Florida, Mike McHarg.
Hi, everybody.
Did I say your name right that time?
You got it. Nailed it.
Good. You also go by the name Science Mike, which is a nickname given to you.
Definitely given to me, not chosen. But not, yeah.
You don't have a tattoo of that anywhere, do you?
Not that I've told anybody about.
This would be a great time to tell people.
Yeah. No, it's a friend sort of coined that at a party, and it's stuck like a tattoo, really.
How long ago have you been given that?
Well, a funny thing about me, I don't have any real concept of time.
Oh.
So really things are in the past or the future or happening, and that's about as granular as I get. So I honestly, if I estimate something like that, yeah. I could be off by a matter of years.
Was there some sort of like X-Men type mutant experiment on you that destroyed your ability to tell time, or what happened?
I'm actually learning disabled.
Oh.
So
well, now I feel like a terrible person for making a joke about that.
it's all good.
Gosh,
I'm learning disabled and fabulously intelligent, so it's a combination.
I like that you have no problem admitting either of those two.
Very humble, very yes. humble as well.
So. You're very high in the humble rating, so good for you. Well, hey, I heard a little bit of your story on the Pete Holmes podcast. This is a podcast that I really enjoy, and so I'm assuming a few of our listeners probably haven't heard your story, but it's a really riveting story that I think people should hear a little bit of about before we get to the How Your Brain is Wired for God post that just went up on relevantmagazine.com. So you grew up in Tallahassee since you were four. You told me that before we started recording.
That's right.
And you grew up a part of a conservative evangelical church, right?
Yes, sir.
And so got married.
Mm-hmm.
This is not going to be a yes or no interview. I'm just going to tell you things and you say yes, no, yes, no.
Yeah. I really am enjoying it. This is like the easiest interview ever.
Outstanding. Okay, so you grew up in this evangelical church and then something happens to you.
Yeah.
Like you stop believing
in God.
Yeah, that doesn't go well in evangelical church or any church usually.
It really doesn't, no. And it's probably made worse that I was a deacon.
Oh.
And yeah. I taught Sunday school,
mm-hmm.
Played in the praise band. Was on a lot of church committees, including search committees to find staff members, and
mm-hmm.
And didn't believe in God. Kind of a pickle.
Yeah, if you had to pick one, praise band, teaching Sunday school, or a deacon, which one of those can you hide the fact you don't believe in God the easiest?
Clearly, praise band.
Exactly, that is the right answer. No doubt about it. No. What do you play?
Bass. Been playing bass.
Oh yeah,
for over 20 years.
Yeah, people don't even know if you actually are alive. You just do the finger and you're...
Well,
the
I am a pretty riveting bass player, I will say that, so...
Do you, like, really get into it?
Totally.
Do you dance?
It's ridiculous. Like, it's embarrassing. And the sad thing is, if I'm playing in front of people or, like, on the couch, it's the same amount of just funkadelic groove that happens. Bass players who are listening know what I'm talking about.
I really respect that a lot. I'm glad to hear that. Okay, so tell me a little bit about what caused this lack of faith to show up, or your disbelief, or whatever you want to say about it, skepticism.
My dad was a Baptist music minister and had an affair and left my mom.
Hmm.
And being a young conservative evangelical, I saw that as a sin problem and saw the solution being... church discipline, really. Like, so we had this family meeting and dad said that the marriage was going to be over. And I basically rebuked him and told him it wouldn't be, and that he needed to cast the devil out of his life. And I told dad I would be like his accountability partner as he rehabilitated himself and got back into a right relationship with God, which seemed like a fabulous plan at the time.
How old were you? Was this right around 25?
No, I'm older than that. It's
So you had already stopped. Okay, yeah. Time questions. Yeah, sorry about that. But you had already.
My wife, if she listens later, will roll her eyes right now because okay, she could tell you the day. But
sorry, Mrs. Science Mike, about that. But you're married. You were a deacon. You were leading church. You were leading in your church when this happened.
Yes.
And so. Your dad has the affair. He tells you this. You're going to cast the devil out of him. You're going to be his accountability partner.
So I decide it's time to... I'm also a nerd. and nerds master everything through research and knowledge. So I said, this is really simple. I'll just like memorize the Bible real quick. And make sure I have all of God's answers by a complete familiarity with the scripture. I've always been pretty active in Bible study, but I'd never taken the thing cover to cover. And I didn't want to misspeak on something so critical. I didn't want to give Dad my opinion. I wanted to give him God's.
Yeah.
And so I read the Bible four times in a year. And instead of finding answers, I found questions. And
really?
Instead of finding peace, I just had more difficulty than I'd ever had reconciling things in the Bible with things I saw in the natural world and understood through science. And even more troubling, I had trouble reconciling the Bible with itself. I used an Excel spreadsheet to keep track of verses that confused me and seemed to contradict other verses. Could that be nerdier, by the way?
No, there's no way that could be nerdier.
Maybe
no.
If I wrote my own database to track it, that would be nerdier. But other than that, Excel's pretty bad. I'm a legit nerd, by the way. So
that's impressive.
And it just kept getting worse. So I'd pray and I'd say, you know, God, you got to help me with this because I know you're right and I'm wrong, but I can't see the puzzle. And at some point I sort of forgot about the divorce and forgot about my dad. And it became very much my attempt to master the Bible and to understand God.
What were some of the questions that were coming up?
Genesis 1, Genesis 2, okay. They're not the same. The morality of God, you know, I would read about the promised land being settled and God saying, go in and kill every woman and child and livestock. And I would go, wait a minute. Yeah. This is the God who sent Jesus on the cross and he's commanding the slaughter of innocent children. How long was the flood? What day did it hit the mountain? So what I eventually did is I said, okay, so science just must be wrong. I'm going to surrender to the Bible and let the Bible be the Bible. But when I would just take the facts in the Bible and try to put them with other facts in the Bible, the pieces didn't line up. And that was deeply troubling for someone who's been raised in a culture where the Bible is inerrant and the perfect author word of God. And my faith was indivisible from the reconciliation of the Old and New Testament, and the prophecies concerning Jesus and all those sorts of less spiritual or less church historied folks who are listening. I apologize for going that Bible nerdy. But those things were intrinsic to my faith. Even though Christ had always been active in my life, and even though the Spirit of God had always been near me, my understanding of that was completely tied to my understanding of the Scripture. So I started reading about apologetics much more than I ever had. And the answers really disappointed me. I didn't find them logically convincing or cohesive. And around that time, a friend of mine who's an atheist bet me. I'd been raving about Rob Bell's Velvet Elvis.
Okay.
And he said, well, I'll read Velvet Elvis if you'll read Richard Dawkins' The God Delusion. So I did. And so began the end of my faith. And essentially, I started reading a lot of the writings of secularists because they made sense to me.
Mm-hmm.
And found myself praying one day and said, God, I don't know why I'm praying. You aren't real. And that was the end of my belief.
During this journey of yours, were you communicating this with your wife, who I'm assuming was also conservative evangelical as well?
No, I realized I couldn't just show up in my marriage and my church and my family and say, hey, guys, I don't think God is real. That would have been calamity. And I also felt like, you know, people who weren't familiar with these lines of questions, it would hurt their faith. Mm-hmm. So I made the decision to go silent and stealth and not tell anyone. So I pretended to be a Christian. I continued to teach Sunday school. I continued to play in the praise band, do all those things, lead people to Christ, led my oldest daughter to Christ as an atheist.
Wow.
Yeah. So I just lived a lie that I thought was beneficial.
What was harder to tell, that story to your church or to your wife?
Oh, my wife.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, my church, I didn't tell anybody about the atheism, really, until I was back. My wife and my mom are the only people who I told, I didn't even want to tell my wife, you know, if you have a good marriage, which I do, your wife knows you really well.
Yes.
And
yes.
It was clear to her that something was off, and she didn't know what, but she sat on the couch one night and basically found a loose thread and pulled till the sweater fell apart, you know?
And you didn't want to tell her, but she just drug it out of you?
I didn't, because then she wanted to correct me. And mm-hmm. to have that conversation, she had to know what my concerns were. And she wasn't ready for my concerns about scripture. She wasn't ready for my questions. And it ended up being something that was very destructive in her faith walk as well. Because, you know, and two nights and hours spent in discussions, it was not a single issue she could raise to defend God that I could not dismantle.
How did your mom find out?
Well, I swore my wife to secrecy, and a few days later, she called my mom.
that secrecy didn't go too well for you, did it?
No, but you know, the way I think about it, who else? She was alone.
Of course, yeah.
She couldn't talk to me about my atheism.
Mm-hmm.
So
why did
she talked to my mom?
Why did you swear to secrecy in the first place?
Well, she agreed. It wasn't the words. We agreed secrecy was best because of the calamity it could cause in our community if I said I didn't believe anymore or mm-hmm. even was struggling with doubt. You know, I'm a leader in a Southern Baptist church. That's not going to be something that improves people's lives. It's not going to be something that helps. You know, the atheists were able to convince me God wasn't real. Mm-hmm. I was never convinced that faith was a bad thing.
Hmm.
Explain that. Well, I know people who have been, I know people in my life who were, say, heroin addicts and had a conversion experience and stopped using heroin and now serve in church life and work in charity and rehabilitate others.
Wow.
That's good. I don't care. At that point, God may not be real, but if belief in Christ heals marriages and heals lives, who cares if Jesus is real or not? You know, if Santa's not real, but kids are awfully good in November, right?
Yes.
So I just decided to roll with it.
And so was that going to be your plan? Like, I'm not going to believe in God, but I see the benefit of church and faith. And so I'm going to play this game, dare I say? I'm going to play this game for my family, for my community, because I think it's best for them.
Yes. Now, on the internet, anonymously, I critiqued the damaging things about faith, of which there are some.
There are some, yeah.
And I also helped people who were going through deconversions find some degree of hope in humanism. Because a common thing when people lose God, who really, really cared about God deeply and had what we would call a personal relationship with God, a sort of understanding of God that is God is involved in my life regularly. Those people tend to have tremendous existential angst when they lose God. And I would basically counsel them.
Why do you think that existential angst comes out?
Because you believe God to be the source of morality, meaning, and purpose.
Yeah.
And if suddenly morality, meaning, and purpose don't exist, that's rough on a human being. Pretty good studies tell us that meaning is one of the most fundamental drivers of mm-hmm. humans. In fact, humans are willing to sacrifice their lives consistently if they believe that their death has meaning. Mm-hmm. That's something unique to our species. So when you take a person who is deeply religious and they lose that faith and they lose meaning, that's actually a state of tremendous vulnerability psychologically.
Yeah. And so you were there during that time for them, trying to help them guiding them through this.
Right. I didn't have an agenda. I would say I said, first of all, you may end up believing again. This might not be permanent. So have hope. Second of all, if you never believe again, it's not that bad. Let me talk to you about the secular scientific understanding of the afterlife, of ethics and morality, of purpose, all these sorts of things. And I'd talk to them about, you know, astronomy. It's a pretty good methadone for former believers. The vastness of the universe is very awe-inspiring.
Hold on. Can we go back to that sentence? Astronomy is a great methadone. How great is that sentence right there? That is amazing. Okay, so that's really good. Okay. So you're pointing towards other things that can help them, but the first thing you said was you might believe again.
Yes.
Where did that come from? Why was that your first thing that you were communicating?
I'm an empiricist. I believe that which can be proven by evidence. And I've got pretty good data that shows me that on average, 41% of people in America today go through some form of faith transition in their life,
mm-hmm.
leaving their faith or joining a different faith. That includes people who become non-religious. 41% of them become religious. And some percentage of them flip. So the faith transitions aren't always permanent. So based on good statistical data, I can tell people, you may have become an atheist, but statistically speaking, it's not certain you will remain one.
Did you make a spreadsheet and count all the people and come up with 41%, or is that from someone else?
That's a study.
Yeah, oh, okay.
Which
okay.
I can send you that study if you'd like it. It's fascinating.
Okay, okay. So this is a situation you're in. You don't want to. You don't believe in God. You don't have faith yourself, but you're going to believe that faith is beneficial. You're not going to tell your wife. You're not going to tell your church. She finds out. She calls the big guns in. She brings your mom in.
Correct.
And so what happens next?
I have a star party. For all my Baptist friends, which is where you take a telescope and look at the universe. And
I was expecting drugs to be involved in that. That's far disappointing. Oh, man. Okay, go ahead.
So, I was a good dry Baptist. What can I say?
Okay, so you bring them over. They're going to see some
over,
stars.
We look in the telescope. Lots of fun until we looked at Andromeda, and I mentioned it was 2.5 million light years away. So the light that we saw from Andromeda left it a million years ago, at which point one of my friends said, that's impossible. Andromeda is only 6,000 years old.
Oh.
So I realized I wasn't as good at pretending as I thought.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, people cleared out probably a little after midnight, finally. And mom kind of hung around. And there was this vibe in the room. And I use this phrase a lot because I can't think of a better one. But it's like, you know, there's an elephant in the room, but you don't know what color it is. Like something is, something's going down, but you don't know what.
Yeah.
And, she told me she'd talk to my wife and I was like, oh no. And basically my mom and I had a multi-hour debate of theism versus atheism. Okay. Me as a reluctant, participant and, probably 3 o'clock in the morning, my mom said, well, you just have all the answers, don't you?
And what did you say to that?
I felt awful because I didn't think I had all the answers. I just had really good criticisms of religious belief. That's not synonymous with all the answers, right?
You just had good questions.
And I would have loved for mom to win that fight. I didn't set off on some mission to disprove God. I went off on a mission to find him. Mom ultimately said, well, I'm going to pray for you. I'm going to pray that God moves so powerfully in your life that you can't deny that it's him. And I thought, well, that's sweet. Thank you.
Why did you say that's sweet?
Some people get offended when people, and you can say, well, I'm just going to pray for you and mean it like as an insult. And that's a really jerk move. Let's be honest.
Mm-hmm.
But most people, when they say they're praying for you, they're saying, I remember you and I care for you deeply. And people who believe in God and believe in prayer, what they are saying is, I am going to appeal to the highest authority possible on your behalf with all of my soul.
Hmm.
And that's a beautiful sentiment. Even if you don't believe in God, for someone who does to pray for you is a sign of tremendous caring and compassion.
So you're genuinely saying that is sweet, not as though that's a pejorative, oh, that's a sweet little thing for a kid to do, but as an honest statement, you really were appreciative of that.
Deeply appreciative. Yeah.
Even at that moment, not like looking back. And then
even in that moment.
Okay. Yeah. So your mom prays that you're going to have this experience where you will definitely know that it's God. What happens next?
I get invited to go to NASA.
Okay.
And, NASA's Dryden Flight Research Center is a really cool place. It's going to be open to the public for the first time ever. So they invite social media influencers out to basically see all of NASA's toys.
Okay.
Pretty good gig. And so I book a flight to the West Coast.
Was it kind of like that scene in Armageddon where they're playing on all the toys before they go up into space?
A lot, yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, they've just got... I mean, they've got supersonic aircraft and, there's a bar where the Apollo astronauts used to hang out while they were training for missions. And, like, it's a cool place. And another friend of mine, after I'd booked my flight, said, hey, he works for Rob Bell. He said, Rob's going to be doing this conference called 2 Days with Rob Bell. Would you help us test the web form sign up? Because you're a nerd and we need nerd help. And also, we'd really like you to just go. It's mainly going to be pastors, but we'd like a few non-pastors there just for different perspectives. He had no idea. I didn't believe, right? Remember, at this point, the circle of trust is three people, me, my wife, my mom. And so I said, yeah, I'll go because I work in advertising. So Rob Bell, I don't care what you think of him, whether you're a Christian, be that conservative, evangelical, or progressive, or an atheist, or a Muslim, the guy is phenomenally creative.
Mm-hmm.
And creativity is such a part of my work, and he seems to have almost limitless creative energy, and I often feel like I have almost none. So I thought, forget God, I'd just love to steal this guy's playbook on creativity.
Okay.
So I decide, and the amazing thing was, it was 40 minutes from NASA, where the conference was going to be.
Is that 40 minutes with a supersonic plane, or just 40 in a car?
40 minutes in a rental car.
Okay. Okay.
And so...
Far closer.
Far, far closer. So, and it was, I was in NASA Thursday, Friday. This was Monday, Tuesday.
Oh, wow.
So the dates lined up perfectly. So I said, yeah, I'm already going to be in California. How weird is that? I went to the conference and it was great. It was everything I thought it was going to be. It was about creativity until, Rob started talking about atheism. And suddenly I felt like I was in a room with like Jerry Falwell. Because Rob would say these quips about science and about skepticism and about atheism that I found offensive as an atheist.
Can you give me an example of one of those?
Well, only with the disclaimer that Rob is a wonderful human being.
Yeah.
Because I'm speaking from the past. But actually, evolution can tell you why you have a tail. It can't tell you why you find that interesting.
Okay. So why, like, explain how that's offensive to you.
Evolution can absolutely describe why you find that interesting.
Really?
Natural selection pressure over time favored intelligence and inquisitiveness. That's the thing that separates us from other animals.
Hmm.
So the fact that you're curious about the tail is a more defining feature of humans via natural selection than our lack of tails.
Interesting.
So basically, yeah, any quip you would have like that, my brain. Now I'm a very friendly person, so I have a million thoughts a second I never say, right? Because there's this like very, very coldly rational part of me that loses every battle with my big-hearted self, right? So I'll think a million things like that and be like, "Well, who cares?" Right?
Mm-hmm.
But he said enough that finally I couldn't take it anymore. And so I raised my hand and said, "Listen, you said this was a participatory experience. You said we could talk about whatever. I just got to wind the clock back." And I basically politely and with good humor dismantled everything Rob had said in the last 15 minutes.
Wow. How did that go over with Rob?
That's the surprising thing. The last thing I said was, "So Rob, how can any person who understands the universe at all possibly believe in any God?"
Wow.
Which, you know, and I expected like, okay, you're out of the conference, bud. Like that's what I expected. But instead, and this is why Rob is a person of almost singular compassion. He leaned forward and he said, "Thank you for sharing and for being honest. I think we all needed to hear that." And I was like, "What?" You know what I mean?
Yeah,
like, it was like so.
You weren't expecting that.
Balancing. And then he said, "Listen, you are obviously very smart. You're very dialed in. And your whole life, you have been able to master your reality by understanding it and categorizing it and putting it in boxes." True story. Yeah, he's right. He said, "But there's something that you don't understand. And I know that because you've flown across the country to meet with pastors. So there's something in you, something in your bones that cries out for God, but you can't find anything that will fit in your God box. Your category for what should be God is empty."
Mm-hmm.
He said, "So just try this as like an experiment. Make a new box in your mind. And in that box, put all the things you have questions and are uncertain about, all the things that you can't figure out. And when you're done doing that, write God on that box." And if that's all you can do is admit there are things that you don't know and call those God, I'm here to tell you, something other people in the church haven't, that's enough. Because you just told me you don't tell people you're an atheist because you don't want to hurt their faith. That's what we call sacred. You're already following Jesus, and you always have been. So just keep doing it, and you don't have to figure anything out. And I might not look any deeper than that. And when Rob said that, I had this moment of intense spiritual energy. I had a feeling that God was near that I had not had in the 2 years since I became an atheist.
Okay.
For about a half second, sort of a, and then it was gone. That was interesting. And a little bit later, we took communion to end the conference, which I thought was super cheesy and lame, to have like this high end sort of thinkers, like a TED for Jesus, and and then turn around and do like the youth group communion thing. But Rob asked us, you know, if you don't know what to pray about, just pray, how could I be broken and poured out for others the way Jesus was? I thought that sounds like humanism, so I'll try that.
Mm-hmm.
So I prayed that prayer, and nothing happened. And I walked up to take the bread and had an existential moment of crisis because I realized I didn't believe Jesus was a real person, so I couldn't accept a piece of bread that represent Christ's body being broken because there was no body to be broken. I was about to turn away when I heard a voice say, I was there when you were eight. I'm there now. I'm here now. And
what does that mean? I was there when you were eight.
I was a nerdy kid. I had no friends. So in recess, I would run away as fast as possible, try to get to the trees so the bullies wouldn't beat me up. And I would spend my entire recess talking to Jesus. How depressing is that story? Obviously I was the ugly duckling. By the time I got to high school, I had lots of friends and everything was fine. But I had a rough childhood socially. Mm-hmm. So I took the bread because I heard the voice, even though I didn't know what that meant. And I drank from the cup. And
hold on, you didn't know what it meant that I was there when you
I just
were eight,
heard. Or... No, I heard. I knew that was like what I was interpreting as the voice of Christ. I knew that, but I was like, what is going on? There is insufficient historical evidence to indicate that a person named Jesus ever existed. And if he did, what correlation or relation does Scripture have to him, since it seems to be so deeply flawed and its authorship is in question? And it's just, at least as far as secular academics are concerned, a lot of the content of the New Testament is forgeries. And there's all these sorts of very, very deep concerns I had with the core of the Christian experience. But at the same time, I felt like Jesus was with me. So I took communion. And then a couple hours later, had this like profound mystical experience on the beach where I felt like God was with me and that I could sort of glance through reality and see him. Mm-hmm. And a classic, they're studied. You can Google mystical experiences and learn about that. And but basically time stood still and everything made sense for a moment. And God and I were back.
So it's weird for me hearing the story because everything is rational. This doesn't make sense. There's questions about authorship. There's questions about the consistency of these stories and historical and science. And then it's experience. Like your experience is what awoken you to faith again.
Yes.
How do you reconcile that?
Because I'm human.
Okay, I agree with that. You are human.
Right.
How does being human...
We have this mistake in modernism that's unscientific, that humans are like these inherently rational actors.
Yeah.
We believe ourselves to be basically machines of thought.
Yeah, no, no.
And our thoughts are like decorations in the rooms of our brains.
Mm-hmm.
They're way, 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 way. If our brain was a house, rational thought would be on our shingles.
Yeah. Jonathan Haidt wrote the book Happiness Hypothesis and... something about how religious people can't get along, but he builds on the work of Hume, and his metaphor is our passions are like an elephant, and the rider on top of it is the intellect, which is really just doing PR for the passions inside of us. And so we're all just trying to make sense of the passions which are driving us. And our thought process and our critical thinking is really just us trying to explain why we have the passions we already have.
Yes. So one thing I read that was really interesting was our ability to make rational argument didn't develop as a means to find truth, mm-hmm. but as a means to convince the rest of the tribe.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So absolutely. Basically, I had this experience and I put it in the God bucket. I said, I don't understand any of this. And what mm-hmm. I told God was, I don't get you. Let's just talk about that. In the meantime, I will partner with you, whatever you are, to try to make this world better. But I just want to keep talking. I don't want to go back to that state where you, whatever you are, and me, whatever I am, are separate. Yeah. I want to puzzle this out with you, God.
You basically told God you wanted to date, but you didn't want to be boyfriend and girlfriend yet.
I don't know. No, I was absolutely committed.
Okay, so you're boyfriend and girlfriend with God.
It was instead of blind dating, it was blind marriage.
Okay.
You know.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
You know what? You're like behind a veil. I've never seen you, but let's tie the knot.
Wow.
And it was a rough period of like reconstruction, which isn't over. One of the most unsettling things about me to like really traditional Christians is the degree to which I hold nothing certain, really. My theology about God is very, very, very loosely defined. And the way that I justify following Christ and studying the scriptures is pretty different. I think that upon further reflection, it's not that controversial to say that Jesus was a real person. Where the real secular controversy lies is with a resurrection.
Yeah.
So I accept a resurrection as an assumption that I can't prove, but that changes my life. Mm-hmm. I can A/B test in my own life what it's like to accept or reject Christ's claim of rejection. Accept that claim, things are better. So I'll go ahead and admit to anybody, any secularist, anybody who doubts, no, I can't prove an empty tomb. I just assume it. But when I assume it, my life is different. When I can consider issues of my life through the stories and the teachings of the Old and New Testaments, life is easier for me. When I engage in my life in conjunction with healthy Christian community, my marriage and my relationships are stronger and better. So I don't have to figure out substitutionary atonement. I just have to know that this is something that works for me, and following Jesus is a choice that I have made.
What do you say to the people who are not satisfied with that line of reasoning, who say, well, just because it feels good to you and it helps you doesn't mean it's right? What is your response to that?
No, every positive fact claim I make about God, I'm ready to defend.
Okay.
We don't understand gravity really well, but we understand some things about gravity, mm-hmm. right? Gravity is a really fundamental thing in physics. We mm-hmm. don't know how it works. We don't know what its particle force carrier is, if there is one. It doesn't fit in the standard model of physics at all. And yet we say, well, things are held together somehow, and it's measurable in some ways, we're going to call that gravity.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I say we were created by something. And religious people experience something when they congregate and pray. And I just call that God.
Mm-hmm.
If it turns, you know, I don't assert for sure that God has consciousness. You know, I don't know that for sure. I experience God as having consciousness, but that could be a projection of my own brain. I just admit those things. I admit the weakness of my position, but the strength of my experience. You know, there's lots of things that you could say are not necessary. You don't need Twitter to communicate, but a lot of people use Twitter.
Mm-hmm.
You don't need ice cream to survive, but a lot of people enjoy ice cream.
Ooh, I don't know about that. I need it to survive.
Exactly. But that comes to my point. There's a great thing, and the reason I wrote that article, that humans have such a powerful predisposition towards religious belief that it is healthy and beneficial to engage it. That's not saying it's unhealthy to be an atheist. If somebody wants to be an atheist, I say more power to them. If they will meet me at a homeless shelter on Saturday morning, if humanism brought them there, great by me.
Yeah.
But what motivates me in my life is the story of Christ and his sacrifice.
Yeah. Obviously, you're building a lot of the work from, I think that you've actually tweeted this to me a few weeks ago. The book was what is the name of the book? How God Changes Your Brain.
Yeah. Right? How God Changes Your Brain by Andrew Newberg.
Yeah. And so fantastic. That's it. I saw a couple comments on your post on Relevant Magazine, and a couple of people are asking, what is the research behind that? And it seems like that's a lot of the work that you're building on in that post, right?
Yeah. There's another one, which is, When God Talks Back, Understanding Evangelical Relationships with God, Evangelical America's Relationship with God, super catchy title.
Yeah.
By Tanya Lerman. She's an anthropologist.
Mm-hmm.
Those are probably my two favorites. There's many others.
Yeah. Well, in How God Changes Your Brain, there's a line that they talk about how the human brain doesn't need to worry if the things that we see are actually real. Instead, it only really needs to know if it's useful for survival.
Yes.
And so,
yeah, absolutely.
Kind of unpack that. Seems to be kind of what you're building is this idea that it's useful for survival. Therefore, we hold it to be true, or we hold it to be something worthwhile. But a lot
more
of,
than that, I also assert that God is real.
Okay.
I don't just say God is a helpful fantasy.
Mm-hmm.
Love is real. Love doesn't exist necessarily in a material way, other than a manifestation of a certain type of electrochemical behavior in human brains.
Mm-hmm.
But love is real.
Yeah.
No one would argue that love doesn't exist. Now, does love have some greater sort of immaterial force behind it? Well, science doesn't see an indication that it does.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm free to hold those ideas loosely. God, the experiences people have with God are real.
Mm-hmm.
And the things that make us, the physical matter we're made of, is a nebulous sort of interaction between energy and the Higgs field. Matter just barely exists. And
the Higgs field?
Higgs field. You've heard of the Higgs boson, right?
Yeah, let's just pretend like I haven't for the sake of my listeners.
The Higgs boson is one of the major discoveries of the Large Hadron Collider, which is a very impressive particle accelerator, the largest particle accelerator ever built. It accelerates protons to a very high fraction of the speed of light,
okay,
and then smashes them together.
Okay.
They're trying to create conditions similar to the early universe so that we can learn more about how the world is composed. And the way science works is you build a model of something, and that model has to explain things we see about reality today.
Mm-hmm.
And it also has to make predictions that you can test.
Okay.
So one of the major, major fundamental understandings of reality is called the standard model of physics. And a scientist named Higgs
made
a prediction that there would be a boson that represented a particular kind of field called a Higgs field. All subatomic particles are nothing but energy that interacts with different fields. The Higgs field is special because it creates mass.
Okay.
Nothing has mass unless it interacts with the Higgs field. So a Higgs boson isn't what creates mass. A Higgs field is, but the Higgs boson proves that the Higgs field exists and that the standard model of physics is valid. So all of reality is this sort of nebulous, mysterious, almost mystical energy. And some secularists will listen to that sentence and say, pseudoscience. No, think about it. All the stuff that we think is solid is made up of particles that have electrical charges that repel each other, but we think at least those particles are solid. But no, they're just energy that interacts with the Higgs field, slows down below light speed, and in doing so, gains mass. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
I am perfectly comfortable calling forces like that either God or the hand of God. And science doesn't understand them completely. I certainly don't understand them completely. But I am completely comfortable saying that which created us and that which we experience in reverence is God, whatever that may be.
Wow. For a minute there, I kind of felt like Jesse Pinkman when Walter White was explaining him anything about chemistry. So thank you for that. Thank you for that. Okay, so you talk about that God does make a difference, a benefit, and you use the language in your piece about how God doesn't come into your heart, but he redecorates that. And that seems to be kind of your way of talking about what How God Changes Your Brain refers to as neuroplasticity. Like, that's one of the ways that God redecorates your brain. Can you speak a little bit about that?
Absolutely. So this guy, Andrew Newberg, who is like the Beatles to me. If Andrew Newberg walked by, I'd like scream and really? Ask for his autograph. Oh my gosh, the guy just does really interesting, good work.
Have you tried to stalk him yet?
I haven't. Mm-hmm. All I've done is mention him in literally every interview I've ever done, and I'm hoping at some point I'll hear one. So, I mean, can you believe that? I'm not even kidding.
Yeah.
So
on your website, it has your name underneath it. It has the word nerd.
Yes.
Yeah. That kind of thing right there really does confirm that. I mean,
it's not just marketing. I really am a nerd. That's
I appreciate you really embracing that. So, okay, go back to your
basically. So when Newberg and other brain scientists and anthropologists have studied people of faith and people without faith, their brains are different.
Mm-hmm.
And it is much more common for people who are religious to engage in prayer and meditative practices for obvious reasons. Now, there are people who don't believe in God, but meditate. And that does absolutely have benefits for the brain.
Yeah.
But when you believe in a loving God, and you pray and meditate on God's love, it changes the way that your brain functions. First of all, the repetition and focus in meditation makes your prefrontal cortex active. Your prefrontal cortex is the most human part of your brain. It's the part that makes you think about the future, think analytically. There's a pretty good argument from modern neuroscience that it's kind of the seat of human consciousness as well. That the observer we think about, where's the observer? It probably lives in your prefrontal cortex. When you focus in meditation, that part of your brain gets healthier. It gets more rich, it gets more dense, it gets more active, which improves focus and concentration.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? That's a good thing.
Yeah.
It also helps you improve, between the interaction of your prefrontal cortex and your hippocampus, your memory function. It's even been shown in Newberg's research to have a therapeutic effect on dementia.
Mm-hmm.
People will pray and meditate, or people who are older, further on in life, that have memory difficulties.
Yeah.
Another thing that happens in your brain as you experience God is your anterior cingulate cortex also becomes more active. That's the part of your brain that lives between your neocortex and your limbic system. Your limbic system is the ancient sort of rat brain, fight or flight expert in your mind. Your anterior cingulate cortex, though, is responsible for love, compassion, and empathy. So when you're consistently focusing on and experiencing God's love and believing in God's love, it becomes easier for you to be compassionate and empathetic towards others. Not only that, when you observe things in your environment, the more you're connected to God's love and the more you're praying and meditating on God's love, the more likely you'll respond to any given stimulus or situation with love, compassion, and patience versus anger. Because your brain is expensive. It requires a lot of oxygen for its size and a lot of nutrients to operate. 25% of your oxygen goes to something that doesn't move and is quite small. And because of that, your brain can't fire everything it wants. It's too expensive. It has to be selective about how much circuitry is running at a time. And so your prefrontal cortex and your limbic system can't both run full tilt at the same time. You cannot be analytical and angry at the same time. And by biasing you through prayer and meditation on God's love towards prefrontal and anterior cingulate cortex thinking, it makes it more difficult for your brain to do the fight or flight, flare up angry, flare up fear thing.
Hmm.
So it actually makes you a more patient, more thoughtful, more compassionate person.
And so that's how the brain is redecorated by God.
One of the many ways.
Okay. What about if the God that you are meditating on isn't a loving God, and the way you understand God is maybe a God of wrath and anger, do you think that still has the same benefits, or do you think it would do something different to your brain?
It has different benefits. If you believe that God is angry or wrathful or vengeful, you tend to be really good at impulse control, because you're afraid that if you do the thing that's forbidden, God will smite you. And that is actually relatively effective at behavioral modification in the short term.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, it also makes you believe that if anyone else violates these covenants, God will smite all of us. And so if you believe that God is wrathful or angry or vengeful, you become very concerned with the behaviors of other people in relationship to God. And it makes you want to control the way other people behave. It also makes your limbic system more active instead of less active. You're more likely to respond to things that you and others do with anger or fear.
Mm-hmm.
You're more likely to have elevated blood pressure, more likely to be stressed, whereas with a loving God, your blood pressure is more likely to decrease.
Yep.
So in many ways, it sort of amps up your brain in the opposite direction. Yep. And here is where people find their criticisms of religion. When people believe in an angry God, or whenever authoritarianism is injected into religion, it does become a fairly dangerous social construct that's responsible mm-hmm. for a great deal of suffering. The fact of the matter is, research tells us that the overwhelming majority of people of faith in the world today experience a loving God, not a wrathful one.
Mm-hmm.
And that most people are driven to acts of compassion and acts of service by their belief, not acts of manipulation, control, or destruction.
Yeah. One of the things I found really interesting about Newberg's research is that he compared the post-traumatic stress that people experience coming out of wrathful, angry type of religion to being that of what other people experience in other sort of pretty typical post-traumatic stress syndrome situations. And that reminded me, there was an article that a guy who used to work at, and I don't mean to dump on this church, but the guy who used to work at the Mars Hill, Seattle church. And he talked about, I think the guy's name was Mike Anderson. And he's something about, I think it was entitled Recovering from Being a True Believer. And he said he had what he called post-traumatic, you know, Mars Hill church stress syndrome, which lines up exactly with what Newberg is talking about, that kind of high anxiety, fear-based religion can cause symptoms that really do mirror PTSD.
Yes, absolutely. Because not only do you have a God who is watching your every thought, and I'm not saying this is Mars Hill or not, but in situations where religious authoritarianism exists, people believe they have supernatural authority in your affairs. And that can become abusive quickly.
Yeah.
And destructive. Yeah.
Yeah. But the benefits that you're speaking of is what is the typical normative, more religious experience of a God of love.
And let's be very clear. Based on other research, the loving God, angry God, A or a B, it's a continuum. And so most people live at the halfway point or towards love
mm-hmm.
today. So even in, you know, one of the things that frustrates me very deeply right now is the sort of strife and antipathy between conservative evangelical and progressive Christians.
Mm-hmm.
Both of those groups experience gods that are primarily loving, right? Evangelicals yeah. think that God's love through Christ exceeds his justice, his right? His yeah. mercy is greater than his wrath. And so even if they live a little more towards the wrath end of the spectrum than, you know, progressives, they're still believing in God who's ultimately loving, and they're still basically beneficial forces in the world.
Yeah.
There's just not a lot of faith in the developed world right now that are like angry, wrathful, destructive gods.
Yeah, exactly. You talk about the benefits of meditation. I think in your article, you prescribe 30 minutes a day, four times a week. Can you tell someone how that could help them, and what is a way for them to start if they've never done meditation?
Okay, the easiest way to start meditation, if you've never done it, and this is totally a plug, is to go to theliturgist.com. That's a project that Michael Gunger and I do, and we have a series of guided meditations that you can do, like plug in your iPhone and hit play, and
mm-hmm.
it'll take you through. We have three different ones of different lengths. We're working on more.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a really easy way. If you don't even want to do that, simply find a space in your home that you can devote as kind of a prayer space.
Mm-hmm.
Sit down and have a conversation with God. Thank God for the fact that you exist, that the universe is real, that you can ask questions. Talk to God about his love for mankind and the world, and just focus on those. It's that simple. It will be difficult to do for more than, if you've never done it, at first you'll feel really silly.
Mm-hmm.
So don't worry about that. Just kind of power through it. Pretend if you have to. And then stop at 5 minutes and just do 5 minutes a day at first, and just slowly work up. And if you sort of think vividly, imagine the stories, imagine how he looks upon the disciples lovingly, those sorts of things. Mm-hmm. Visualization and imagination are important. Those are easy. Those are kataphatic practices, meaning with thought and image. Mm-hmm. Other forms of meditation, like centering prayer, are apophatic and potentially even more powerful neurologically, but they're just more difficult. So I typically recommend people either start with self-guided kataphatic meditation or go with a guided apophatic, like we have two centering prayer pieces with the liturgists.
And so they can go to theliturgists.com and get all those resources and try it out there.
Yeah, and that's with an S on the end, the liturgists.
I will put that on my website and link that over there so people can check it out. Mike, thanks for your time, man. This has been a lot of fun.
Yeah, thanks.
Really appreciate it.
Thanks for checking out Newsworthy with Norsworthy. Make sure to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. You are now adjourned.